Americans in the News, the world of bricks and clicks. The Pope beatifies a cardinal, a call for heathen Republicans, yoga strikes a nerve, and Newsweek looks at men. I'm Albert Mohler. It's Tuesday, September 21, 2010, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. For some time now, Americans have been changing how they receive and assimilate the news. For most of the 20th century, the news came by three major means. First of all, the newspapers, which were the most authoritative voice, coming generally once a day, with news that was already at least several hours old by the time that it arrived. Radio had the greatest immediacy, and early in the 20th century, radio became so popular that by the time of the end of the Great Depression, most homes had a radio and received news of any urgency by means of the radio waves. After World War II, television became popular. Three major networks emerged, each with eventually a nightly news program and assorted other programming during the day with special reports added. But now, in the year 2010, Americans are receiving their news through a multiplicity of formats and avenues. Now, writing in the Wall Street Journal, Gordon Krawitz, writing for the Information Age column of the journal, speaks of just how this has been transformed in America. In 2010, only 26% of Americans say they read a newspaper daily. That's down from 30% just back in 2008 and 38% in 2006. Newspaper websites have increased traffic, but that increase in traffic is not coming even close to the peak of newspapers in terms of print editions just 20 or 30 years ago. Americans are changing the way they receive the news, not only because of the internet, but because of changes that are in broadcasting as well. Now get this. Survey participants suggest that they spend 57 minutes a day in assimilating the media. Now, an additional 13 minutes a day is devoted to getting news almost exclusively online. That's over an hour a day. That means most Americans right now are spending just under an hour with older media and then an additional 13 to 15 minutes with newer media. Now, as you would not be surprised, these statistics change when changing from different age cohorts. Older Americans tend to be primarily in terms of the older form of media. Younger Americans are almost entirely in new media, and not only in terms of internet news sites, but social media. For many younger Americans and an increasing number of young adults, Twitter is the first line of news. One of the most interesting analyses of how news now works for the young came from a survey participant in recent years who said, back in 2008, and I quote, "If the news is that important, it will find me." Now, in an age of social media, that's quite a statement. Young people are now convinced that it's something of equal or sufficient importance to interrupt what used to be, say, regular programming on television with some kind of a news bulletin, is now going to find them by means of social media. Rather than having an anchor interrupt a television program, now social media interrupts a conversation in order to say, by tweet or Facebook posting or some similar format, something major has happened in the world. The world of bricks and clicks, that's a language that is becoming more and more common when looking at business on and off the internet. Bricks, well, that has to do with business that takes place in a building. Clicks, you guessed it, business online. In the digital domain column of the New York Times, Randall Strauss discusses the fact that Blockbuster, one of the most important names in terms of the entertainment industry in this generation, is now suffering because its business was built primarily on bricks, while the rest of the world has been moving towards clicks. Now, Randall Strauss, writing in this news column, is suggesting that many businesses are trying to do both. They're trying to do business in a store, then a physical geographical location, and also on the web. It would make sense, you might say, for this kind of diversification. But it turns out that a good many companies simply can't pull this kind of diversification off. They either do really well with bricks or they do really well with clicks. Blockbuster has become a parable for this difficulty. It built its reputation on bricks. People went into their stores, picked out the movie, watched it, and then returned it. But now with Netflix and other online services, people can do this from the safety and security and convenience of their home with the movie delivered to them. But now, of course, with Netflix and other online services, the rental may actually be merely digital, something of a virtual rental without any kind of actual format, whether DVD or VCR, which now seems almost hopelessly outdated. But Blockbuster has been unable to make the transition, as has some other companies. And now, as the New York Times makes clear, well, customers want both bricks and clicks, but not necessarily from the same company. So it turns out that Redbox may be the future when it comes to bricks, and Netflix may be the future when it comes to clicks. To survive in the internet age, well, companies have to have a great deal of dexterity, but they also have to figure out exactly why they should be in business and why customers should wish to do business with them. It will be interesting to see what happens when increased competition comes to both Netflix and Redbox. Both pioneered the way of getting entertainment into the hands and into the homes of people with the least amount of trouble and the greatest amount of convenience, and not to mention low cost. The business models are abounding. A recent analysis indicates that the web is becoming, of course, the major arena for much commerce. While most dollars are still transacted in the world of bricks, inside stores, shopping malls, and all the rest, an increasing amount of this commerce is taking place on the internet through clicks. But customers seem still to want to touch certain merchandise and see certain merchandise. And companies are having a very difficult time trying to figure out exactly what will and will not work online. Pope Benedict XVI has spent the last several days on his first ever state visit to Great Britain. Of course, it's not just this pope's first state visit. It's the first state visit of any pope to Great Britain. We've looked already at the pope's analysis of secularism and his indictment of what he calls an aggressive secularism that now threatens to virtually eradicate the Christian memory from Europe in general and from the United Kingdom in particular. But something happened at the end of the Pope's visit that ought to have our attention, and in particular ought to have the attention of evangelical Christians. Before leaving England, Pope Benedict XVI did something which is of no little controversy. He beatified John Cardinal Newman. John Newman, now known as John Cardinal Newman, was one of the most significant Catholic figures of 19th century Great Britain. But of course, he didn't start out a Roman Catholic. He started out an Anglo-Catholic Anglican. He started out a member of the Church of England. A major theologian and a towering intellect, John Henry Newman was one of the so-called Tractarians, involved in a series of writings that were called at the time Tracts of the Times. They called for a reassertion of authority within the Church of England, a new and vigorous theological expression. Eventually, John Henry Newman became one of the Tractarians who left the Church of England and joined the Church of Rome. Now, when I teach theological method, I make very clear that for evangelicals committed to the Scripture principle, John Henry Newman represents the great challenge to us. Cardinal Newman was beatified by Pope Benedict precisely because he is the kind of theologian that this pope likes. A theologian who is vigorous in his assertion of Roman Catholic doctrine and Roman Catholic theological method. Now, let me tell you why evangelicals should pay particular attention to this. John Henry Newman converted from the Church of England, a Protestant denomination, to the Roman Catholic Church because of the issue of authority. John Henry Newman and some of his colleagues lost confidence in the authority of the Church and of the authority, most importantly, of the Scriptures, and they looked for another source of authority. And in this case, John Henry Newman was led to the authority of the magisterium of the Roman Catholic Church, and in particular of the teaching office of the Pope. Now, when we think about this for a few minutes, the issues become very stark and clear. It is an option. Option A is the option of trusting the Scripture and understanding the Church's responsibility to understand the Scriptures as the sole authority for faith and practice. And on the other hand, losing confidence in the Scripture and then scrambling to find some other authority. You know, back in the 19th century, John Henry Newman discovered that the alternatives were just that stark. Either the Church would trust the Scriptures, or the Church would have to look for a substitute form of authority. And in this case, what he claimed was the venerable office of the Church, of the Roman Catholic Church, through its magisterium and through the papacy. Now, as I said, when I teach theological method, I want my students to understand as evangelicals that these are indeed the options. If you do abandon the authority of Scripture, if you lose confidence in the Scripture as the full authority within the Church, then you've got to find some other authority. And that is exactly why, then and now, some troubled souls find their way into the Roman Catholic Church. I think it's good, even as Pope Benedict XVI now beatifies John Henry Newman, and Cardinal Newman takes the last step toward eventually being declared a saint of the Roman Catholic Church, it's important for us to remember why it was so and why it still matters. Kerry Sheffield, writing in USA Today in Monday's religion column, writes that the Republican Party better recognize that it needs heathens. She writes, as a secularist who votes with Republicans and holds to basically conservative political values, she says we shouldn't be surprised by that, even though most secularists vote with the Democratic Party and in a more liberal direction. She says that she is not alone as a heathen who's basically a conservative heathen. Now, her voice is rather interesting. Her argument is rather, well, curious. But it is one statement in her essay that certainly caught my attention. She writes this: "We secular conservatives are too often shoved into the canonical closet and forced to keep quiet about the fact that we don't want our politicians spouting off like preachers. We'd like to keep and protect religions in the private sanctuaries where they belong." End quote. Well, I'm sorry, Ms. Sheffield, that's the problem. You can't sequester and closet religious conviction, because religious conviction is a part of who we are as citizens. It's a part of who she is by its absence, as much as it is a part of anyone else, whether an evangelical Christian or an Orthodox Jew or a Mormon or a Muslim or a Hindu, for that matter. Our convictions inevitably shape our worldview, and as such, they inevitably bleed out and bleed into the decisions we make in everyday life, from economic decisions, yes, to political decisions, whether Democrat or Republican. You know, I'm continually amazed by secularists who really imagine that people who have theological convictions have a religiously shaped worldview, while secularists do not. Now, let's remember, the absence of these convictions is as informative on a worldview as the presence of them. Newsweek magazine's out with a fascinating cover story. We're going to be talking about it more as the week unfolds. It's entitled "Man Up, the Traditional Male is an Endangered Species. It's time," says the magazine, "to rethink masculinity." Well, I think when we take a look at this argument, we're going to discover it's not exactly what we might think will be attractive either to men or to women, nor good for either as we move into the future. But speaking of controversy, yesterday I posted at my website and on iTunes a new edition of Thinking in Public, my long-format interview program. In this case, it was on yoga and the story of yoga in America and the questions if Christians should practice yoga. At the same time, I published an article at my website entitled "The Subtle Body, Should Christians Practice Yoga?" Both the radio program and the article have received a good deal of attention and stirred a good deal of controversy. To the question, should Christians practice yoga? Well, I'll just give you here the short answer: no. In the article and in the broadcast, I make clear why it is so. I go back to the history of yoga, helped by Stephanie Simon, the author of the new book, The Subtle Body, The History of Yoga in America. We look at the roots of the practice of yoga and the fact that yoga is inseparable from its spiritual foundation. The very essence of yoga is to see the body and the discipline of the body as a conduit for contact with the divine. That is a very different theological direction than biblical Christianity, and for that reason, I believe that Christians should be very, very wary of yoga as a spiritual practice, or even as what they merely think is a physical discipline. If it is merely a physical discipline, well, the experts in yoga will tell you, it's not really yoga. Kathy Lynn Grossman of USA Today picked up on my argument and on the controversy and wrote an article at the website of USA Today. She asked for comment, and so do I. It'll be interesting to see where this story goes. I will tell you, I'm a bit amazed by how many Christians have written in to say that they do believe it's possible for Christians faithfully to practice yoga. However, when they actually define what yoga is, either you have to question whether a faithful Christian can participate in it, or you really have to question if what they're talking about is yoga. Well, this much is clear. The story is going to continue. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You'll find a wealth of resources at my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me at Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler for regular updates during the day with links to other articles and items of interest. I hope you'll want to come to Southern Seminary's Preview Day. It is the greatest opportunity to find out what Southern Seminary is all about, meet professors and administrators, get to visit the campus, and understand exactly why we're so excited about what's going on at Southern Seminary. Southern Seminary Preview Day is October 15th, 2010. For more information, go to our website at sbts.edu. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.